From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Robert Siegel. Some 6 million Americans have been out of work for 6 months or longer. They're known as the long-term unemployed. For many, the longer they're out of the workforce, the harder it is to get back in. As part of our Road Back to Work series, NPR's Tamara Keith gives us a glimpse of what it's like to be on the job hunt as weeks turn to months and months to years.
Okay, it's Ray Meyer, Sunday, January 23rd, and I'm going on the internet and trying to find some jobs.
Meyer is 55 years old and lost his job as a regional bank manager more than 2 years ago. He had spent a 30-year career in banking.
This is Cassandra. It's January 11, 2011. I'm about to apply online for a marketing administrative assistant position.
Cassandra Bronner has been unemployed for just over a year. She's 39 and spent 11 years at Anheuser-Busch, working her way up to a marketing manager job. Both Bronner and Meyer want to get back to some semblance of the careers they had before. And both have been documenting their job search by keeping audio diaries.
Let's try Craigslist. Dependability, reliability, piece of cake. Attitude, piece of cake. Flexibility, piece of cake. Quality of work, teamwork. Oh, I can do all those.
I am about to send this off and cross my fingers. Here goes nothing. Send.
There are the little victories, the encouraging recruiters, the friends who say they can help make a connection, the job interviews. And then there are the defeats, the applications, dozens of them that seem like they're going into a black hole, the rejections by form letter.
Dear Cassandra, while impressed by your credentials, after reviewing your resume, we have decided to pursue other candidates.
For Ray Meyer, the frustration and financial stress have been building.
I'll be real honest with you. I don't understand, with my background and my experience, why I'm not getting any calls back in for some of these jobs.
Meyer's unemployment benefits ran out in November after 99 weeks. You'd think after 2 years of hustling, of applying for every banking job that comes up, and quite a few low-wage retail positions too, Meyer would let up or give up, but he hasn't.
Hi, Kathy. This is Ray Meyer.
Today, Meyer is making phone calls, networking with old friends at banks where he'd like to work.
And I just, I've tried places other than banking, but most places are afraid of hiring me for fear that when things do pick back up again, I'll leave, them and go back to the bank. So it's damn if I do and damn if I don't,
For the long-term unemployed, the issues Meyer faces are the norm. Bill Emmons is an economist at the Federal Reserve Bank of St. Louis.
Your job network starts to dry up. People won't return your calls. The stigma that your potential new employer says this guy's, he's been out of work for 18 months. What's wrong with him? Then it's, feeds back on itself.
Bronner is a single mom with two daughters in elementary school, and her job search is getting urgent.
I just got home from church. I really enjoyed the preacher's sermon this morning. I even got him to do a special prayer over me about my job situation. And he believes, and I believe, that I will find something really soon.
And then things do start to look up. She gets a call from a recruiter. He's hiring for a marketing position at a company where she'd love to work. They arrange a phone interview.
I am nervous because I haven't been on an interview in a while, and interviews make me nervous anyway. So I'm preparing, I'm going over my questions, I'm going over the job description, kind of getting myself together here for this interview.
Once the interview starts, Bronner records her end of the conversation.
From the job description, it seems like it touches on a lot of things that I have experience with. Managing workflow, handling multiple projects, dealing with internal customers as well as external customers, just kind of keeping everything going.
Bronner seems to be at ease, describing her skills and making the pitch for why she should get the job. In all, the interview lasts a little more than an hour.
Just call me back. I think that's it. Okay, thank you. You too. All right, bye-bye.
2 weeks later, She's still waiting. Apparently, there were hundreds of applicants, and it will still be a while before any decision is made. Bronner remains hopeful. Ray Meyer also has his hopes up. He's had a couple of interviews at banks recently, though no job offers yet. In the meantime, something else comes up, a lead on a temporary data entry job.
I really need a job, and if I have to take this data entry position just to have a little bit of extra cash, then I'll sure as heck do it.
Meyer took the job. It's on the graveyard shift. He's hardly sleeping. But he's glad to be working and still searching for the job that will get him back to the career he loves. Tamara Keith, NPR News.
American workers have become more pessimistic about their financial well-being in retirement. In a new survey, 27% of workers said they were not at all confident they could afford to retire comfortably. That's up from last year. NPR's Wendy Kaufman reports.
Jack Vanderhey co-authored the Employee Benefit Research Institute's Report on Worker Confidence. It's a report the nonprofit Nonpartisan Group has been doing for 21 years.
And this year was without a doubt the worst year ever in terms of worker confidence.
The percentage of workers who said they were not confident they could retire comfortably has grown 5% in the past year. The biggest increase was among those who actually are the least prepared for retirement. Vanderhey suspects that with all the economic and housing news in the past year or so, the individuals finally took a hard look at what they had and what they would need.
In previous years, we had a lot of problems with what we call false optimism, and I think realism is starting to finally set in.
So, have they started to save more?
The answer, unfortunately, is not yet.
But Vanderhey hopes their more realistic assessment will prompt them to set aside more money. While individual retirement needs will vary widely, one rule of thumb says you should have a nest egg of about 10 times the amount of your annual earnings. So, if you bring in $50,000 a year, you should plan to have about $500,000 for retirement. Wendy Kaufman, NPR News.
Global stock markets have been tumbling because of the ongoing nuclear crisis in Japan. Then there's the trouble in the Middle East and rising gas prices. To sort out what's going on in the markets and what investors are saying about the economy, we call David Wessel. He's the economics editor of the Wall Street Journal. Good morning, David.
Good morning, Linda.
Let's start with stock markets. Japan's market has crashed. Stocks are also down sharply in the U.S. and Europe. How nervous are investors?
Well, I think, of course, we have to recognize this is a human tragedy, the loss of life, the destruction of communities, all this radiation scare. That really can't be measured in dollars and cents. But I think what the markets are telling us is, wow, this is scary. We don't really know what's going to happen with the nukes in Japan. And uncertainty is never good for stock markets in the first place. But especially with all that's going on with oil prices, this has just been one big blow to people's confidence that the world economy is going to keep going and be getting better and better, which had been the case before this.
Now, also today, Japan's currency skyrocketed to an all-time high against the dollar. At one point, it was about 76 yen to the dollar. Shouldn't that also be falling, given the troubles the country's having?
Yeah, that really is an interesting phenomenon. Basically, Japan is a big supplier of savings to the rest of the world, and a lot of people have been using the yen to do sophisticated trades. But this episode seems to have brought a lot of the money home and has people trying to buy yen to close out various positions. That's driving up the value of the yen, at least temporarily. The Japanese Central Bank is trying to resist it by printing lots of yen. And most of the economists to whom I speak think this isn't going to be a long-lived phenomenon, but it's a worry for the Japanese. It makes it harder for the plants that are operating to keep exporting. And it does illustrate one issue. If Japan is going to use more of its savings to rebuild itself after this disaster, it'll, of course, have less to lend to the United States, which means we'll either have to save more or pay higher interest rates.
Japan's economy has been in the doldrums for years. Still, it is critical to some industries like cars and electronics. So will this crisis affect the world economy?
Yes, it's still a big economy, although it represents 6% of the world economy. China has become bigger than Japan. It makes a number of critical components in autos and computer chips, and so they'll have to have some supply response there. Someone else will have to make those things if we're going to get them. I think, as I said, the shock to confidence is the greatest. But I think also it's just we don't really know because we don't know how bad this nuclear thing will be. I know tonight at our time, the finance ministers and central bankers around the world are going to have a big conference call to begin to talk about whether there's something they need to do in order to protect the world economy and help Japan.
David, often some kind of a disaster can be a big hit to an economy initially, but then there's a sort of a bounce back after hurricanes, for example, when rebuilding goes on. Do you think Japan is going to bounce back?
Well, I think initially people thought this is kind of like the Kobe earthquake in 1995, when Japan bounced back much more quickly than pessimists had expected and the rebuilding went much better. Rich, resilient country. Evidence is that rich countries come back sooner from these disasters, but this really is unprecedented. And until we know how much of Japan may be uninhabitable, how long it'll be before they can learn how to deal with the radiation, I think it's premature. But the thing we've learned is that in the last week, this has turned into a much, much more serious economic problem and environmental problem for Japan, and that suggests that the effects will be much longer lived, the bad effects, than we thought just a few days ago when it looked like it would be more like the Kobe quake.
David Wessel is the economics editor of the Wall Street Journal. David, thank you.
You're welcome.
And the cost of a college education isn't the only thing going up. Try buying a tank of gas. A gallon of regular unleaded has topped $3.55. Rising gas prices don't just affect how or how much Americans drive. They could affect what Americans drive. NPR's Sonari Glinton reports on what that means for the recovering U.S. auto industry.
The American auto industry is very different now than the last time gas prices took a steep climb. To find that out, all you have to do is go on a test drive of a brand new car.
Let's get you behind the wheel.
All right, let's...
Do you actually want to drive or do you want to be a passenger?
I want to drive.
Okay.
So if that's all right.
And I'll hold the mic?
Yeah, you can be the engineer.
Excellent.
Lou Eklund is one of three Ford executives who on a rainy day went with me on a test drive of the new Ford Focus. It's a compact car that comes with all the bells and whistles, navigation system, moonroof, leather seats, 11 different sets of rims, no spinners yet. It's the kind of car none of the U.S. automakers made very well, if at all, a few years ago.
What we're finding is customers are paying higher transaction prices for nicer cars. And so we're making vehicles that we've invested mightily in technology and fuel economy. And as a result, we are...
This must be like the worst road ever.
I think you did pick the worst road ever.
Ford has the Focus and Fiesta. General Motors has the Aveo and the Chevy Cruze. And Chrysler will soon get the Fiat 500. All are small cars with high fuel economy, and each of them can be tricked out to your heart's content. Not like the old Econo boxes. And slowly but surely, Detroit is shifting its attention from SUVs to cars. For instance, in 2004, 65% of vehicles Ford sold were trucks and SUVs. In 2011, that number dropped to 40%. So as gas prices go up and people begin to look for more efficient cars, Eklund says...
We're prepared for it. And I think largely the industry has been prepared for it. Not to toot everybody's horn, but corporate fuel economy has gotten generally better.
Michelle Krebs is an analyst with Edmunds.com. She says with the high cost for pensions and retiree health care, the Detroit automakers could not make real profits on anything but big cars and SUVs. But that was before the recent bankruptcies and restructuring.
All of the automakers, Ford, General Motors, Chrysler, pushed their break-even points way down. And so they are much more able to weather downturns, whatever they're caused by, gas prices, than they were before because they've cut costs so dramatically.
Nigel Galt is an economist with IHS Global Insight. He says while Detroit may be poised to handle a gas price increase, there's still the overall economy to think about.
I think the big question is whether people who have jobs start to fear that maybe even though they survived so far, they might be at risk of losing their own job.
Galt says we're not at that point yet. But he says when consumers feel that gas prices could stall the economy, the first place they'll cut back is big ticket purchases such as cars. It may not be a fatal blow, but it'll still hurt. Sonari Glinton, NPR News.
This is NPR News.